So yeah, so I would just like to add my personal thanks to the organizers. So it's been great being here. So I guess the title of the program is Fundamental Aspects of Superstring Theory, and I'm going to try to live up to that in this talk. There will be nothing even remotely phenomenological in any of this talk, okay? It's just going to be about string theory as string theory. And so, I mean, fundamentally, what is string theory? Well, I mean, one way to think about it, or one of the defining properties as a physical theory, is it has the following sort of funny structure to it, that a space-time or a field configuration, or a point in phase space, if you want, of the theory, is represented or is defined as a particular two-dimensional quantum field theory, which is going to live on the world sheet of the string, and space-time properties like equations of motion, classical equations of motion, or supersymmetry properties, and so on, are transformed into particular properties of this two-dimensional quantum field theory, like conformal invariance or whatever. So in that sense, the theory itself, the actual string theory, is like a meta theory that controls this space of theories, of two-dimensional theories. So it's this funny theory within a theory structure, and of course that's, you know, one of the things that gives string theory its power and makes it so rich, and it constrains, obviously, the types of space-time theories you can get. So that's, you know, kind of the whole, well, one of the whole points of string theory. And so in this talk, I'm going to give an example of how this structure constrains the form of the space-time theory. And the example is going to be really, really, really simple. Okay, so I think it's going to be, in the sense that I'm hoping that, you know, somebody who's paying attention will actually be able to follow almost all of the actual derivations. That's how easy it is. And I should say from the outset that throughout the talk, I'll only be talking about classical string theory. Properties of basically the classical action for string theory. So to get started, let's actually just recall some basic facts that I and probably many others in this room learned from Joe's book, Chapter 3. So so that's so that if I make a mistake, we know who to blame. Right? Okay, so let's just do the bosonic nonlinear signal model. So I'll put a hat, when I remember, on world sheet actions or two-dimensional actions. So for the moment, let's forget about string theory, and we're just dealing with some interesting two-dimensional quantum field theory, coupling constant alpha prime, and the fields are X's, so we have D target space fields X mu, which parametrize some target space manifold, which I'll call M, and it has a metric on it, and here's our action. So this is the two-dimensional curvature. Okay, and now let's recall the well-known beta functions for the couplings, which are this metric and this dilaton. So we have the coupling for the metric. And let me try to attempt, at least for the first couple of equations, to get the numbers right. Okay, so in an alpha prime expansion, this is the first which is roughly speaking a loop expansion. This is the first non-trivial order. Actually, there's a minus oneth order. Plus d mu phi squared. Okay, so higher orders. And what I want to do is I just want to point out two properties that these beta functions have. The first property is pretty obvious. The second property is very far from obvious, but is very well known. So the first property is what I'll call factorization. This is just a two-dimensional quantum field theory. These are its beta functions.
I meant beta phi, you mean d minus 20?
No, this is the beta function for this coupling in this quantum field theory. Okay. Yeah, there's no, I'm just doing this quantum field theory. Yeah. Okay, so by factorization, what I mean is the following property, that if we consider the target space to be a product, okay, for example, so topologically a product of two manifolds, and also metrically, so that the metric, so here I'll call the coordinates on this one x1 and x2. X1 and x2 are sets of coordinates, okay? They're not individual coordinates. So if we if it decomposes metrically, so that the metric decomposes in this way, and the dilaton also, okay, and you take this metric and dilaton, you stick them in here, okay, then the beta functions decompose, okay, so beta g, the 1-1 components will be what you would have computed from this metric and this dilaton, and similarly the 2-2 components and the 1-2 component will vanish, and the dilaton beta function will be the sum. Okay, and well, so that's because the Ricci tensor in a product metric is block diagonal, and the Hessian is clearly block diagonal D. So obviously D is equal to D1 plus D2, so this splits, the Laplacian splits, the square of the gradient splits. Okay, so now, all right, is that just kind of an accident? I mean, would we expect that to continue to hold at higher orders? Is it an accident of the lowest order? Well, no, of course it's not an accident at all. It follows from very sort of obvious property of two-dimensional quantum field theories, which is just that, you know, when you have this particular target space field configuration, then the action decomposes into a sum of an action for the target space M1 and a separate action for the target space M2, which means that the quantum field theory decomposes into a product, tensor product of two decoupled quantum field theories, and then the beta functions for one don't even know what the beta functions for the other are, or whatever. Okay, so therefore we would expect this to hold higher. In fact, if you look up the next order, you will see that it's some product of Riemann tensors and also obeys this factorization property. Okay. Yeah.
And is there any reason you're setting d mu to zero, or just?
Oh no, I just to decrease the amount of writing. Yeah, sorry. It holds also with b mu nu. And the second property is that these beta functions are derivable from a functional that is called the space-time action. If you just... write down this functional, take its variational derivatives, well, then you find, in computed variational derivatives, you find that you get the beta functions, or more precisely, the beta functions are linear combinations of the variational derivatives. And first of all, they mix with each other, and also the proportionality constants are field dependent. There's, you know, e to the minus 2 phi's and root g's and so on. You can find the formulas in chapter 3 of Joe's book. And so this property is, of course, very natural from, so this is the property that leads us to call this thing the space-time action, because the classical equations of motion are the vanishing of the beta functions. Actually, it's the vanishing of the total beta functions here. So the full world sheet theory has other parts to it, the ghosts that could have other sectors and so on. And then what you want is the vanishing of the full beta functions, and those other sectors contribute other terms to this. Actually, there is another term here, which I totally left out, which is proportional to d. Sorry, plus some d over alpha prime with some 3/2 or something, something like that. Sorry. So then there's another term from other sectors on the world sheet, and this continues. This relation continues to hold, and so on. So I mean, from the space-time point of view, of course, the existence of the fact that the equations of motion are derivable from an action is very natural, but from the world sheet or quantum field theory point of view, it's sort of mysterious. At least I find it slightly mysterious that you have beta functions that are sort of gradients of some functional. And I mean, this is a question that's been thought about and investigated. So in the context of the sigma model, Tseitlin has given arguments that this property holds to all orders in alpha prime. That it, and in general. It would certainly be good for, if you have some theory which you claim to be a consistent classical theory, if you just write down a set of equations of motion, you should be able to derive those from an action, or you're going to have to really worry about their consistency. Okay, so certainly from a space-time point of view, it's very desirable and natural for these things, if they are going to be equations of motion, to be derivable from an action. Okay, although it's far from obvious that that should be true from the point of view of studying two-dimensional quantum field theories. Okay.
Isn't there a theorem in two-dimensional quantum theory that the beta functions are always gradient?
No. I mean, in certain contexts, there are. So I'll mention, since you asked, in very narrow contexts, there are such theorems. So Friedan and Konechny in 2002 proved that property for renormalizable boundary couplings, assuming that the bulk is described by a CFT. That's outside of that, I think there are arguments, but it's there are no theorems. Yeah.
Don't you know that it's not reliable if the space is very small? For example, because it isn't very useful in small radius.
Well, the question of it being, this, of course, is not reliable because of this. That's a separate question from whether this property continues to hold at higher orders in alpha prime.
Well, you're just
in the sense of the existence of an action.
It would have to be an action with an infinite number of
Well, it would have to be an action with an infinite number of derivatives, and then the fields. Let me get back to that, actually, the question of whether it would have to include an infinite number of fields.
You have the mass of string states if they're not.
From a space-time point of view, it seems like it should have an infinite number of fields, but from a world sheet point of view, that's not clear. Can I get back to that?
So the criterion that the beta functions are gradients of something, does it follow from the non-degeneracy of the Zamolchikov metric?
No, I mean, it's not even clear whether this is the Zamolchikov metric. The Zamolchikov metric is really well defined on the moduli space of CFTs. When you go off of that, here we're not on the moduli space of CFTs, so it's it's not really clear what metric in general should appear in this.
So maybe this is just an annoying technical question, but in the superstring theory, you're eventually going to get a self-dual field, and writing down actions for self-dual fields can be a little sketchy.
In that sense, now of course there you have to be really, really careful if you don't have an action to know that your theory is consistent and so on.
Matt, one more question. Yeah. I mean, if you're really taking this seriously off shell, mm-hmm. would you have to worry that you have to consider 2D field theories with also irrelevant operators added? And then you need to tell us how to define that?
Well, okay. I mean, since you're... since you're entering into this already, I guess I would say it this way. We don't know, but one might have thought, one might have hoped, that there is such a thing as the space of renormalizable two-dimensional theories. Okay, I mean, we talk about those spaces all the time in other dimensions, and by definition, on that space, the beta functions stay in that space, the RG flow stays in that space, and indeed, that's what happens with these boundary couplings. Okay, and therefore, one might have hoped that the same thing applies also to the bulk. Okay, so one of the questions, since you're pushing me on this, one of the questions I want to answer is whether there exists something that like this, but when you add another renormalizable term, namely the bulk closed string tachyon. Okay, that's a renormalizable
coupling
on the world sheet, and so one might have hoped that the beta functions are derived also from an action in that case. Okay, so all right, let me leave that as kind of some tension waiting to be resolved.
Although
okay.
The tense you used might have hoped.
No. Don't think too much. Okay. So that's what I had to say on that. Now what I want to say, I want to get back to this factorization thing. And what I want to say is that if somebody gives you some classical field theory, it's very unlikely to obey this property. I mean, the summary of this property is that a configuration that's a product solves the equation of motion if and only if each factor solves the equations of motion. Okay, if you have some free field theory, then it'll often be the case. But let me just give you a couple of examples to convince you that that actually it's a very unusual property for a field theory to satisfy. So, for example, 5-4 theory, so a single scalar field, the equation of motion is like this. And so if I have some 5x1 x2 is phi 1 of x1 plus phi 2 of x2, and I stick it in here, then this thing splits into del 1 squared of phi 1 plus del 2 squared of phi 2. But of course, this one doesn't split. Okay? And similarly, if you just take, if you take pure gravity with zero cosmological constant, then it splits because you can write the equation of motion r mu nu equals zero, and we already saw that. But if you take gravity with minimally coupled massless scalar, so something as simple as that, okay, then one equation of motion is this, and the other one, the equation of motion for the metric is this. Okay, this one splits, that's fine. This splits, it's block diagonal. This is not block diagonal. Okay, so so it doesn't have this property of factorization, okay? And this property of factorization, I should have said before, you know, when I first saw these beta functions, I mean, they're obviously very reasonable equations of motion. They're a form of the Einstein equation, but I was sort of curious, how come there's not like in the usual Einstein equation, you have this term, Rg mu nu, and I was just curious why it doesn't appear, and this factorization explains why it couldn't possibly have appeared. Okay, g mu nu factorizes its block diagonal, and r by itself is r1 plus r2, but of course the product doesn't, so it's disallowed. So that's a fast way to see which terms are allowed and which terms aren't allowed to appear in these beta functions. Of course, some of the terms that are allowed don't appear. For example, you could have had just the Ricci scalar by itself. In the dilaton beta function, it's not there. So my point is that imposing this condition strongly constrains what the form of the equations of motion, and therefore, if we assume the equations of motion come from an action, the form of the action can be. Okay, and it's very simple in a given case to do the exercise and to see, does it obey factorization, does it not obey factorization? Okay, and that's basically what we'll be doing for the talk. Now, let me say, and what I'm going to do, I should say, not all string fields are expected to obey factorization. It depends on how they couple on the world sheet. So I'm going to give a list of ones that do and a list of ones that don't. Okay, so just to avoid confusion. But and I'll do that in a second. But first I want to say one other thing, which is that you might be a little bit surprised here. I'm saying that this system does not obey factorization, but I told you the metric dilaton system does, and they're the same, I mean, up to some field redefinition. So what's going on? The point is, the property of factorization is not invariant under nonlinear field redefinitions. Okay, so and from a world sheet point of view, why is that? Well, basically, roughly speaking, a field redefinition, a space-time field redefinition, is a change, can be understood as a change of renormalization scheme on the world sheet. And this statement that I made before, that I said was so incredibly obvious, that if you have two decoupled quantum field theories, the beta functions for one don't depend on the other. As blindingly obvious as that statement is, it actually does depend on the scheme. So if you choose a stupid enough scheme, or maybe I should say a simple enough scheme, like just something like using as a regulator that points are not allowed to come within a certain distance of each other when you're computing correlators, something like that, you will find that this property doesn't hold, that you can have two totally decoupled theories in the ultraviolet, and when you compute their beta functions, they will appear to be coupled in the sense that in the infrared, there'll be terms in the effective action that mix the two theories that have nothing to do with each other. Of course, the coupling will be fictitious in the sense that if you actually go and compute a correlator in this scheme, you will find that they still factorize as they must because the two theories really are decoupled. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to work in. I'm just going to assume that we're in a scheme like DIMREG or something nice where decoupled theories stay decoupled under RG flow, and then we are not going to be allowed to do nonlinear field redefinitions. Okay, we're only going to be allowed to do linear ones. Yeah.
Stupid question. Then. Could I take your theory here with the additive solutions that don't work, the phi 1 plus phi 2? Go back to string frame, transform both solutions to string frame, add them, and transform back and get a new solution for phi 1 and phi 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can, in fact, add solutions in a really complicated way.
That's right, yeah. But if we're using as our definitions of the string fields, you know, the couplings that appear in the in the world sheet action, which is sort of probably the best thing to do, then we can just use those. We don't have to ask the question, is there some nonlinear field redefinition under which this thing does satisfy factorization or something like that? Okay. Okay, so what string fields do we expect to obey factorization? Factorization. Okay, so I've already said the metric, the dilaton, the B field, And that's in the bosonic and superstring theories. Okay. Okay, in the bosonic and type zero theories, the bulk closed string tachyon because the world sheet action there is just it's just a potential on the world sheet like this in this for the type zero there's another well you're just also it's a superpotential but it's same logic holds open string gauge fields. In bosonic and superstring, because they're it's just d tau x mu in mu of x, and then it's a little more complicated in the superstring, but and the bosonic open string tachyon. Okay, whose coupling is just the same, but where you're just integrating over the boundary, not the open string tachyon in the superstring. Okay, and I'll say why in a second. Okay, so some examples of ones that don't. So basically, when it fails, it fails because what happens is that on the world sheet, your fields are coupling to some third field, and so even though in the action the part for the x1 might split from the part with the x2, if they're both coupled to some y field, then the theories don't decouple from each other. Okay, so the open string tachyon in superstring theories. And so there, it's because they there's this funny discrete field gamma that lives. This here, this is a superfield, and this is the field that this is a fermionic field, and because. Even if you have a situation like this, x1 will couple to gamma and x2 will couple to gamma, so they won't. So you won't get two decoupled theories. Okay, and yeah.
You say tachyon and open superstring, so you have to specify whether it's a brain anti-brain or non-BPSD brain, or, because there are no tachyons in superstring, right? Otherwise.
Well, there are tachyons on the wrong type of D-brain in superstring. Or in type zero, and I mean there are open string tachyons in the superstring, and on D anti D pairs, as you say. So all of that information is contained in the structure of this gamma, but it's true for all of them. There's no open string tachyons in the superstrings that have such a simple coupling on the world sheet.
You are in the correct GSO sector.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean this. Yeah. If you ask me too many questions about this, I'm not going to remember. Right? but this is true. This part is true. And I should even name. I mean, there's this. Okay, I don't know if they did it first, but this Kutasov, Marino, and Moore have this. I hope I'm not offending whoever did it first, who might be sitting in the audience.
Or listening in.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, similar story for compactification moduli. Okay, and by the same logic, you know, any kind of localized tachyons. Okay, because their worldsheet coupling couples them to third fields. In this, you know, in this case, to the fields of the compactification directions, compactified directions, and so on. Okay, and then the transverse scalars on a D-brain. Okay, which aren't really additive couplings in this sense, in the sense of something you add to the worldsheet action. And indeed, if you just look at the DBI or Nambu-Goto action, you know, and you write down the equation of motion, it does not obey this. Okay, it's like these kind of things.
Number two, suppose you have a product of circles, right? There are radii of each of the circles, which are compactification moduli. And the two circles are
just... Yeah. Let's do one circle. Okay, so then you have one modulus, okay, which is a field in the non-compact directions. Now let's call that field phi. So then there's an action on the world sheet, which is like 5x. So x are the non-compact directions times dy d bar y, where y is the compact direction. So even if phi splits like this, it doesn't buy you anything because you're still coupling x1 to y and x2 to y. And so the x1 theory on the world sheet and the x2 theory on the world sheet aren't decoupled. It's a little confusing because you'd say, well, this is just a metric thing, and I told you the metric does. But what I meant was, you know, the x1 components of the metric depending on x1 and the x2 components of the metric depending on x2.
So
basically, I mean, the basic idea I think should be clear now is, you know, this factorization is a strong constraint. Let's assume that some given string field, the beta functions are derivable from an action. And then the idea, in some sense, is to avoid actually computing any beta functions. That's secretly what we're trying to do. Just don't actually compute them honestly. Just write down the most general thing, impose factorization, and see whether it tells you what the beta functions and what the space-time action are. Okay. So let's just do, as a warm-up exercise, a single scalar field. And we'll make the, after we do the exercise, we'll make the connection to string theory, you know, which scalar field, you know, what string field are you talking about? Let's just see if I write down an action for a scalar field. So let me just write down the most general, and I'm going to work at the two derivative level. And because I'm not allowed to make nonlinear field redefinitions, I have to retain the kinetic term, the non-trivial kinetic term. So I have two unknown functions at this level, at the two derivative level. Okay, and so you do the variation, so you get, this is what you get, del squared phi g prime of phi d mu phi minus v prime of phi, okay? And now you might say, well, okay, so one thing we know is that with this ansatz, you know, del squared phi splits, d mu phi splits, and so then you might say, well, if you want this to split, then this g of phi has to be a constant in g prime, well, then g prime would be zero. That's too strong, because actually the beta functions don't have to equal this, they just have to be proportional to it. So what we really need is for, what we're basically saying is that whatever the beta function is, it's gonna be something like 1/g(φ) times this. Okay, if we're gonna have any hope of making this work. And so then, for it to work, the constraint is that g prime over g is constant, and v prime over g is proportional to phi, is linear in phi. Okay, so you want this to split. Yeah?
Are
from the point of view of the tensor product field theory, why would you expect a non-trivial proportionality function there, as opposed to just the beta functions equaling something that splits?
Well, I mean, since I don't think, or we understand, or at least I don't understand why from the 2D quantum field point of view you expect this kind of action in the first place, I can't really answer the question. But basically, I mean, the what's going on is that the sort of general formula, where should I write it, is that what's observed experimentally is that there's some metric which is somehow maybe related to the Zamolodchikov metric, which sort of raises the index. These I and j are field indices. They index which field you have and also which space-time point. And this is a gradient on the space of field configurations, and therefore you need something to quote-unquote raise the index, and that's a metric on the space. So the possibility was clearly there from the get-go. It's not artificial at all. You knew you would need something like that. And indeed, you know, in this case, certainly they do depend on the fields. So what we need to make this thing work is we need this to be constant, and then we need this to split, meaning to be linear in phi. Okay. Well, for this to be constant, there are two cases. So one case is g of phi is just constant. Okay. And the second case is, let me call it G naught, is G of phi is G naught e to the phi. Well, it could be e to the something times phi, but I'm allowing myself linear field redefinitions. Okay. And then you plug it in here, and so what we need is V prime of phi over G of phi has to split. That means that it has to be something times phi, and that's something we would conventionally call the mass squared, some constant, plus some constant times d, because d also splits. Okay. And in case one, we just end up with a free action, which is which, you know, does satisfy factorization. Case two is the more interesting one, so if we want it to be interacting at all, then we do this integral and we end up with the following action. So case two, so this is the basically the potential and the kinetic terms are proportional to e to the phi plus m squared. When you do the integral, you get this for the potential plus alpha d. Okay. When m squared is non-zero, you can shift phi by something proportional to d to get rid of alpha. When m squared is equal to zero, then of course you can't do that. Okay. So that's the exercise. What does it mean for string theory? Well, let's take the case, first of all, that phi is the dilaton. Then we know that, then we can use the information from the free string theory that the mass squared is zero. And then we recover the dilaton part of the space-time action, the metric dilaton action. Okay. There's unknown constants, of course. There's no hope of getting this, and this one is also undetermined. Okay, so this method in general leaves some undetermined constants. But it's interesting that you already get so much, I mean, this particular form of the action. And it's even more interesting in the case when we take phi to be the open string tachyon in the bosonic theory, because we end up with a very particular, maybe even peculiar potential, which is up to some constant e to the phi times phi minus 1. Okay, so I'm saying that if you want an interacting scalar field that obeys factorization, this the potential has to look like this. Now, if you go and look up the potential as computed in boundary string field theory, so boundary string field theory is the form of string field theory where you're where the space-time fields really are just literally the couplings on the world sheet in the sense of the sigma model. If you go and look, so they do these calculations, which you know take a couple of pages or whatever. This is exactly what they find. Okay? So one nice thing is we did it quicker and easier. Now, of course, although we did it quicker and easier, we didn't get all the information they got. They being, sorry, Kutasov, Marino, and Moore, and Gerasimov, and Shatashvili. Because, of course, there's an unknown constant here which tells you the depth of the tachyon potential. I mean, they were interested in proving the Senn conjecture regarding the height of the tachyon potential using boundary string field theory. And, of course, we don't get that information from this. Yeah?
Maybe I'm just misremembering, but didn't their potential go to zero infinity?
Yeah, I mean, it might be flipped which is infinity and which is minus infinity. From their convention. So there's one direction, so I mean it looks something like this, or maybe minus that. I mean this, but the tachyon potential is supposed to look like that.
Now, there was some discussion of DBI actions for open string tachyons. Does that fit in here?
So you want to include the gauge field? Is that?
No, well,
oh.
I'm probably just...
Oh, wait.
Just the tachyon itself, there was some story of Senn's where he thought the action boiled down to a square-root form.
Yeah, so but that's not a true derivative action.
Yeah. You are restricted.
I restricted to, and this is a good place for me to, before somebody jumps on me and says, why are you talking about a true derivative action for a string scale tachyon? Very good question. Thank you for asking. Okay, so this is actually a crucial point, which is that, first of all, this is a two derivative action for a string scale tachyon, and therefore you should not use it. You should not attempt to use it to find solutions, except maybe ones that are constant in space, for example, like at the minimum of the potential or something like that, static ones. But any kind of time-dependent one, you should not trust this action. Now, you could say, but then your whole logic is just, you know. But the point of the logic is, I don't care whether my equations of motion are satisfied. I don't care whether I'm not using the idea that the beta function should be small or close to zero or anything like that. Okay, so I can take this theory, which has this world sheet coupling. I can compute its beta function irrespective of whether that beta function is small. And it should have certain properties. And the approximation I'm using is that the space-time derivatives are small. Okay, so I'm within that approximation, which is very different from the approximation that the beta functions are small. But nonetheless, within that approximation, factorization goes through. Another way to say it is that factorization is a property that should hold order by order in the derivative expansion. Okay, so so when you combine that with the fact that the gradient property of the beta functions was proven for renormalizable boundary couplings by Friedan and Konechny, you see that it's not a surprise that this worked. Okay, so it's legitimate to consider an action for just this field all by itself, and it's legitimate to consider a two-derivative action, and within that approximation to find the potential. Now, one thing you can't do, I was tempted to do this for a while, then I realized it was wrong, is I was gonna fix the unknown constants here by looking at what the mass is in the free string theory and looking at let's say the three point coupling of strings and then reproducing those using this action, but that's wrong because those things actually depend on all of the higher derivative corrections that I haven't included. Okay, so if you did that, you would presumably get the wrong answers. Okay, now you can. this is related to this DBI question. Can you go to higher derivatives? Obviously, you know, it helps that we only had two unknown constants. Two unknown functions in our general action. Can you put higher derivatives in? The more derivatives you put, of course, the more unknown functions there are. On the other hand, the more constraints. It becomes quite messy. I haven't attempted to do the general thing with an infinite number of derivatives, but I have done it for sort of Bornenfeld type actions where you only ever have one derivative acting on each field. Okay, so assuming.
No, since you just said that, I don't think that was a good approximation in the Stakian stuff. So people wrote down this DBA action, but I don't think it was a self-consistent approximation.
Okay.
Precisely this reason.
Okay, yeah, I mean,
the operations were actually large.
Oh, right. Okay. So what I found, and I actually haven't checked it against that work, maybe I should. But what I found is that if you do this, if you assume that the Lagrangian is a function of phi and only the first derivative squared, so as in a DBI type thing, then, and you want it to obey factorization, you get two possibilities. One is that there is no dependence on anything more than the first power of this, which is the case we already saw. But if you want it to have, actually, to depend on higher powers of this, then L is plus or minus, well, up to some normalizations, this. And it doesn't depend on phi. There's no potential. No potential term is consistent with factorization. So that is different from these DBI actions. So I'm not quite understanding the connection. Maybe I should check those things. Because if they were saying that this is the action that gives you the beta functions, then I'm finding that action doesn't obey factorization. Okay.
Can I ask a question on something you said before?
Yeah.
You said you couldn't match them, at least the mass of the tachyon at the maximum to
right.
some combination of parameters in your action. Why not, in the sense that you can measure that mass in a zero gradient tachyon background where your approximations are perfect? I mean, so why couldn't you get at least one constraint on your parameters by matching the mass?
I don't think I agree that you can measure the mass. I mean, for example, you would agree that you can't, given an action, you can't know the mass of some field unless you know the kinetic term, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think you need to know, in fact, all of the higher derivative terms.
Not just the quadratic.
I mean, it's a pole in the propagator, and that's, you know, involves all of the terms. Okay, so we did a single scalar field, and we got the open string tachyon potential, which is fun, but of course we have bigger fish to fry. We want to get the closed string, we want to know what's going on with the closed string tachyon, okay? And we can expect that the closed string, one other thing I was going to say is that you can easily add a gauge field. And you get an action for the gauge field coupled to this tachyon, and it's the same as the one in boundary string field theory. Okay. So the closed string tachyon is presumably going to couple, you know, to the metric and the dilaton. Let's start as an exercise with gravity coupled to a single scalar field, and the constraints you get from factorization are surprisingly strong. At least I was surprised. So our general action, again, two derivative, and of course I'm implicitly assuming diffeomorphism invariance and nice properties like that. So the G mu nu variation, I'm not going to write the whole thing down because we actually won't need the whole thing. Okay, there's some stuff proportional to the metric. And then there's the phi variation as well. But already in this alone, there's a lot of information. The first piece of information is that this term here is dangerous. Okay, we don't like this term because it has off-diagonal pieces. And so it can never obey factorization. So its coefficient had better vanish. So we learn that f double prime plus a half g is 0. And then, of course, these obey factorization separately, so we need their coefficients to be proportional to each other. So f prime over f is a constant. Okay. By the way, implicitly, we should assume that neither f nor g vanishes because we want all of our fields to be dynamical. Okay, so so that means that in particular, we don't want f to be constant, which would have satisfied this, but it would have meant that g is 0. So that's not good. So so then we actually are done because we know what f of phi is. It's just e to the phi, and g of phi is the same up to some constant. Okay, and then you can go and you do the analysis for phi to discover what v of phi is, and you get, and the analysis proceeds quite similarly to here. So this is the final answer. Whoops. Mu phi, mu phi, g mu nu. Okay, here's the potential. Plus, so we have these unknown constants, two of them. And now, if let's take phi to be the dilaton, we'll get back to the tachyon in a second. But let's take phi to be the dilaton. Then we, if we use the information that it's massless, then we recover the metric dilaton action. So see how easy that was? I mean, you don't actually have to compute any beta functions. The only thing we don't know is what this coefficient is. Okay, so I think that that's fun. And you can add the B field, and you get the action for the B field again in this thing. Okay, so it follows almost completely just from this basic property. Now, what if it's the tachyon? So we have the metric and the tachyon. Then it actually doesn't work in the sense that what we know about the tachyon is that if you set the tachyon to 0 and the metric to be flat space, that's a solution to the classical equations of motion. And this action doesn't admit that as a solution when m squared is non-zero. So the beta function for the metric in this system looks like this, plus m squared g mu nu. So that's fine. I mean, it obeys factorization, of course, but it doesn't allow flat space with a constant phi to be a solution. But you might have said, well, I mean, once you include the dilaton and you allow some mixing, you know, maybe it'll fix it up. Okay, so one last exercise is gravity plus dilaton and tachyon. Okay, so but more generally, we'll just do gravity and multiple scalars without worrying about at first about their particular properties. So it's just a question of decorating this with some indices. In fact, maybe I'll just do it that way. Gij, phi I, phi j. Okay. What happens to this? This becomes, let me call it dk phi phi k. This becomes di dj phi, dj f. Sorry, this was f, sorry. These are derivatives with respect to phi. Gi plus 1 half, gij, ij. Okay. And good. So again, this coefficient had better be zero. So we get dI dj, gij is zero. And here we get that dkf over f is constant. Let me call that, so that's a vector in the space of phi's, which I'll call ck. So then f sub phi is e to the ck by k, and gij is minus a half ci cj e to the ck by k. Okay, and now I haven't even worried about the potential, but we're never going to get there because we're already dead, actually. And we're dead because when you look at the kinetic terms in the action we get, so we've already determined all of the kinetic terms. They involve the metric, and they also involve this one combination of scalars, ck, phi k. Only one combination is dynamical. The rest of the scalars have no kinetic term. Okay? So the full kinetic term looks like this. And no, you know, obviously, I mean, it goes without saying that no field redefinition is going to change this fact, and it has nothing to do with what the potential is. Okay? The full kinetic term is e to the ck phi k r plus g mu nu d mu ck phi k b nu ck phi k. Okay. Okay, so it's dead easy, and what we've learned is that there's no two derivative action with the property of factorization. For gravity coupled to multiple scalars. I don't care if they're massive or massless or... Okay. So much for finding the closed string tachyon potential.
Why are you looking for factorization?
Did you come in late? I'm not quite sure where to start, but I mean, basically, it's a basic principle you expect for certain string fields, including metric, dilaton, and bulk closed string tachyon. Okay, I guess that doesn't answer the question, it just restates it, but it follows from very simple properties of, it follows from the fact that this space-time action has its origins in a set of two-dimensional quantum field theories, okay, and basic properties of those. Okay, so to me, what the most interesting conclusion, I mean, so you can take different points of view on this. You can be totally blasé and say that why would you? You know, clearly, you know, it's not that there's no action. You know, it's just that the action involves all of the massive fields. I mean, why wouldn't it involve all of the massive fields? And certainly, from a space-time point of view, from sort of an effective action kind of point of view, that's completely true. But, you know, I mean, string theory is not just any old space-time field theory. It has these special properties. And in particular, the thing that you might have hoped, and that does actually, in the case of the boundary couplings, separate out the dilaton, metric, and tachyon from all of the massive string fields, is the fact that on the world sheet they are renormalizable couplings. Therefore, there exist schemes where those couplings where the beta functions for those couplings form a closed system, do not involve all of the irrelevant operators on the world sheet, and so it's it is a question you can ask, it is a well-posed question to ask whether that set of beta functions is derivable from an action on that space of couplings. Okay, and that's the question that people asked in when formulating boundary-independent background, boundary string field theory, and the answer is yes. And so my claim here is that the answer is no. That in the case of the bulk, the answer is no. So there's no. So I think that this implies that there's no. So let me put a question mark here. That there's no closed string analog. I mean, I should say that people have looked already quite a bit for closed string analogs of boundary string field theory.
By that, you mean something with only two derivatives in action?
No, I'm not. No, I mean boundary string field theory doesn't have only two derivatives in the action. I mean nobody knows what it is, but it's, you know, I think it's well defined and it's
it has infinite number of derivatives.
Okay, but a finite number of fields. So
I thought your result was that there was no two derivative.
Yeah. So, but if you took that action, if it existed. So this is one of the hidden assumptions, is that it admits a regular expansion in derivatives. I can take the two derivative part, and factorization is something that should apply order by order in the derivative expansion. Okay, and if that's true, then if you just look at the two derivative part of this action, it should obey factorization. So there should be such a thing. That's how it worked for the open string case. Okay, yeah.
And do you know what the smallest additional set of fields you could add is to get a two derivative action that would obey factorization, or is your statement that you can't?
Oh, no, I mean, I...
So there could still be an analog, you just have to add a set of extra fields?
Maybe, but that would already, I mean, we already know that, you know, in flat 26-dimensional space, the bosonic closed string has these fields, you know, with the B field. The B field doesn't solve it anyway. You could always, you know, you can always get rid of the B field if you want. So.
At the field theory level, your statement is if you just consider renormalizable couplings in the two-dimensional closed CFT, there is no action that gives those beta that closed set of beta function equations.
Right. Yeah.
I actually like this conclusion because various people have argued that when the closed string tachyon condenses, you remove space-time, right? There's no light degree of freedom of the string anymore, and there's no low-energy space-time at all.
Yeah.
So it's sort of good that you're not getting a consistent low-energy space-time description for the motion of the tachyon.
But, I mean, that happens with the open string tachyon, too, within the world of open string degrees of freedom. And yet there is an action. It's just that, you know, the action is not so simple and the minimum is often infinity, and by the time you're done.
But it doesn't remove space-time.
No, it doesn't remove space-time, but it removes the D-brain. So as far as the open string degrees of freedom go, the same logic applies. And yet there it was sort of okay.
But you showed you get a space-time description of the open string tachyon.
But I didn't try to expand about the minimum of the potential, which is over at minus infinity here. And therefore, you know, at minus infinity, in fact, the kinetic terms are gone, and all kinds of weird things happen. So, I mean, and in fact, you know, so I was going to say this before, but I forgot to add to the drama. One of the things that motivated me is that in the last few years, since about 2005, there's been a series of papers where people write down two derivative actions for the metric dilaton tachyon system. So let me name names. It was started out by Yang and Zwieback, and then there was a paper by Jennenberg and Sunita, Bergman and Razamat, Suyama, Brandenberger, Fry, and Kano, and Swanson, all wrote papers in which they wrote down actions for the metric dilaton tachyon system. And the method, generally speaking, was the following. You have some exact solutions, which you know are things like linear dilaton and linear dilaton with various tachyon profiles, which you know are exact solutions to the full string equations of motion. Then you work backwards to find an action where that gives those solutions as solutions, and then you take that new action, you go and find new solutions, various new cosmological solutions or domain wall solutions or whatever. Okay, so I mean, those actions presumably do reflect some aspects of, you know, tachyon dynamics in string theory, but they can't be more than that, you know.
So just going back to higher derivatives, if I understood right, your problem with the two derivative thing is that some of the scalars have no kinetic term of the two derivative order.
Yeah. So maybe they get that's a loophole. So that's one loophole in this. It would be interesting to try to see if you can make that work. It would be surprising. I mean, it would be exotic, but okay, maybe it's exotic. I mean,
as you said, I mean, it would not, you know, if you think of the mass as a pole in a propagator, that could as well come from a quantum.
Absolutely, it could. So the statement would, so I mean, we know that the dilaton gets its kinetic term already at the two derivative level, but maybe the closed string tachyon is some exotic field that only gets its kinetic term at, you know, God knows what order. So that's a loophole. Yeah.
So since your methods don't apply to things like localized tachyons, it's still possible that those have
actions. Yeah. I mean, I would like to. I don't know how to do this, but I feel like there's a larger structure here. I mean, the way I did it was just, you know, you write down the most general thing, then you see if it obeys factors. I mean, ultimately, one would like to sort of say that in general, actions which obey factorization are, look like this, they have to look like this or something, and then maybe even more generally say that, you know, because of the way that it comes from the two-dimensional theory, the space-time, something that goes beyond, something that works even for these fields that don't obey factorization. There should be some deeper structure here. You know, one shouldn't just have to work it out like each case separately kind of thing. But anyway, that's just speculation. Yes?
Does the factorization really hold for the bulk closed string tachyon when you added the dilaton and all these fields? Is it like sort of obvious that your basic assumption is like valid?
So my basic assumption is that there exists a scheme in which factorization holds.
Is it obvious?
No, but if, I mean,
for some of the fields it's not true, right? So,
well, but you know why it's not true there. So naively, it's saying somehow that you know, when you write down the Lagrangian and then you try to quantize on the basis of the Lagrangian, you are completely fooling yourself about how the couplings work. Basically, that there's no scheme that respects the structure of that Lagrangian. I don't know.
So suppose you didn't insist that your beta functions came from an action. You just try to write down beta functions. Then could you write down?
Yeah. Then there's tons of, yeah.
So maybe it's not, but you say there's proof that in this case that it comes from an action?
No. There's just, absolutely not. I mean,
you keep quoting some free.
Oh, but that's for boundary couplings.
I see.
When the bulk is a CFT.
I see.
But then for Seidlin, what did you say about
Seidlin? So Seidlin has some arguments that, but that's for the sigma model with only massless field. I think his arguments only apply.
And it's
an order by order in alpha prime, and so on. Now, the idea that there's just no action, you know, string theory doesn't have an, you know, classical string theory doesn't have an action.
It could be that it has an action with all the massive fields, but beta functions in this renormalizable space.
Right, so that's, yeah. Right, so that's, I think that's an option. I don't know of any theorem that violates.
Though I suppose you could integrate out the massive fields. So you get something horribly non-local, but
yeah.
Some sort of action.
You might think.
Well, I mean, that's what you're doing when you talk about renormalizable couplings,
right?
You're setting all your non-renormalizable ones. You're sort of integrating them out in some sense. So that's within that, yeah.
But you could just directly write down the beta function equations and verify by hand that there's no action that gives rise to those equations in the renormalizable space. Yes? You know the beta function equations in the closed space.
Yeah, I don't, well.
That would be less insightful than what you did, but it would be a check.
Yeah.
Right, maybe this is said that you could compute the beta functions, right? Is that what you said, guys?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the problem there is that, well, I haven't seen anywhere where somebody has sat down and calculated those, and I think, what? I think that there's a lot of scheme dependence. I don't think it's a completely trivial thing to do. I think there's
because this is not a marginal operator.
Yeah, because you have an
small complicated sum.
Yeah.
And then the miracle would be that they have consistent solutions even though they don't come from an action. Somehow that would be the miracle.
I guess so. I mean, one of my points is that this is easier to do than. So, yeah.
The subluxury of C function can be used as an action, right? But that's not local or, it's not explicit.
The Zamazov C theorem, or?
It gives you a function, an explicit function, which is stationary and unsolute. Right?
Yeah, but I mean, nobody has proven that the gradient of that is the beta functions. He proved it in conformal perturbation theory up to a certain order, and the first non-trivial order. And what's great about that paper is that if you can use his formulas to very straightforwardly, you don't have to do any work, check to see whether that claim holds at the next order, and it fails. At the next non-trivial order in conformal perturbation theory, the beta functions are definitely not the gradient of the C function. I'm sure he knew that. I mean, it's like.
Suppose you just drop the dilaton field, right?
Mm.
Suppose you're really just working in flat space.
Mm-hmm.
On the world sheet, there's no dilaton field. Then the action that you get from just the metric, the equations of motion that you get from metric don't follow from an action, right? Even though the two directly.
Oh, you're just doing the metric, no tachyon, just the metric alone.
Yes.
Yes, I think that's correct. Yeah.
So it can't be a very general property about.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we agree that the dilaton is somehow essential. I mean, it's not really,
But some general theorem about conformal field theory, you're saying you'd have to couple it to Curtin manifolds.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I've actually thought about this before, the question of whether it's even consistent to get rid of the dilaton. I think the answer is that it's not, that at some point you get a beta function for the dilaton just from the metric alone.
But the dilaton does nothing if you're adjusting.
It does nothing, but it has a beta function.
Okay, but you just don't care about it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's true that you don't care about it because it changes the stress tensor. I mean, I don't think that's really correct. Yeah.
Speaking of things that don't require work, if you take Barton's string field theory and you try and package it in terms of, try and integrate everything else out and look at what mess you get at the level of just these fields, what happens?
Well, you don't expect, you wouldn't expect it to obey factorization. And in fact, for example, an easier case is Witten's cubic string field theory. The action there doesn't because it's not in it, or it doesn't at any sort of naive level because the fields there are related to the sigma model fields by some horrible field redefinition, which is not just nonlinear but totally non-local in space-time and whatever. So you wouldn't, the same is true for this closed string field theory. Yeah. But I mean, which isn't to say that one shouldn't compute. I mean, for its own purposes, one should compute that, and they've been busy doing that and trying to find the closed string tachyon vacuum using that action. But it's really hard because
they couldn't truncate in either derivatives or interaction vertices, right? They
have to. Yeah. So yeah.
So would you say there is no field redefinition that brings you into the factorized form, the Zwieback closed string field direction?
Well, it would have to be, I mean, unless, I mean,
So this will be our thing because you've shown that there are no actions.
Yeah. I mean, modulo these loops, a couple of technical loopholes. Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay, this is terrible. As far as I know, Rob Myers and Chakotay and Suyama have used factorization to constrain aspects of space-time actions for string theory. Thank you for reminding me. So it has been done. And Myers in particular used it to fix some coefficient in the r to the fourth term or something like that. Yeah, so that has been done. So, yeah, right. That's important. So, I mean, yeah, it gets hard when you start going to higher derivatives. I haven't, you know, you get such a proliferation of functions and so on. I mean, it also, you have more constraints, so ultimately maybe it, you know, but I haven't really tried to do that, except for this one thing. That's, yeah, I'm done, yeah.